Good morning, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is Tim Coffey, and I represent the appellant and plaintiff, Diego Gaines. I thank you in advance for your time and consideration with this matter. The matter comes before the Court following the District Court's entry of summary judgment on all Mr. Gaines' claims. In a nutshell, defendant K5 Corporation terminated Diego's employment as a semi-dump truck driver on May 4, 2010, within days and in direct response to his federally and state protected complaints about the safety of two trucks defendant assigned him to drive. The first of his complaints were on April 28, 2010, and the next set of his complaints were on April 30, 2010. The termination also came less than 4 months following Mr. Gaines' filing of his national origin discrimination charge with the EEOC. With all due respect, we fervently believe that the lower court erred in dismissing five of Diego's claims. We humbly ask this court to reverse the erroneous grant of summary judgment as to each of these five claims. Four of the five issues we ask this court to reverse on involve K5's May 4, 2010 decision to terminate Diego's employment. These are the termination claims. As to these claims, Diego has presented enough evidence to create a jury question as to whether K5 terminated his employment because of his national origin and or because of his federally and or state-protected activity.
You know, you in both the record below at the district court as well as on appeal, you tend to completely conflate the elements needed to establish the Title VII claims as they relate to discrimination regarding termination as well as retaliation, and also the STAA retaliation claim. Can you clarify for us what specific evidence you have in support of both Title VII claims? What was alleged?
With respect to the Title VII claims, is both a national origin discrimination and a retaliation claim. We have set forth in the district court the evidence. We didn't label whether he was following the direct or indirect method to the district court on the Title VII claims. With respect to the difference between the Title VII and the STAA, essentially, the essential question is the same. He has to produce enough evidence to show that the reason for the termination, all those claims go to the termination, that the reason for the termination was not honestly held, and the alleged discipline that he received all on the same day after the termination was not honestly believed by K5. So while they're different claims, The evidence goes, all the pretext evidence and the similarly situated evidence all goes to both claims. It all supports both claims. So in that respect, there's no difference between what we were present to prove the Title VII claims as opposed to what we were present to prove the STAA and Illinois public policy claim. The fifth issue that we are asking for the court to reverse is the FLSA failure to pay Mr. Gaines for work that he performed before his scheduled start time. With respect to a couple of the underlying sub-issues, the first is whether Diego waived his direct method way of showing, a methodology of showing discrimination or retaliation. Again, he didn't label his argument in the district court as either one or the other, indirect or direct. And I think most recently, this court has issued a number of opinions that have, and the lower court has, said that maybe these distinctions between direct and indirect are getting not useful at all and more confusing than they are useful.
What evidence, direct or indirect?
With respect to direct or indirect, it comes down to the pretext evidence. And the pretext evidence that was presented here showed that there was no reasonable basis for K5 to believe he violated any rule on April 28th or April 30th. The pretext evidence attacks the supposed legitimacy of the expectations, and it also goes to the similarly situated person that we've alleged, Mr. Konitska, alleged that he was treated much more lenient than Mr. Gaines with respect to alleged falsification of a driver's daily report.
Also, as it relates to Mr. Konitska, are you relying on the fact that we should disregard the other warning slips and only focus for comparative purposes on the allegedly false DDR?
I am. I think and I do want to address that, but I'd like to say we don't see this as a disciplinary history case at all. If you look at what happened here, coming into at the time of the termination decision, May 4, 2010, Mr. Gaines had not received a disciplinary warning for almost 12 months. So there is no disciplinary history
That's not really the set of facts in which you're trying to establish Mr. Konietzka as a comparator. You're saying, as I understand it, Mr. Konietzka violated the same work rule and using Coleman as your support as Mr. Gaines, in that they both were perceived by the employer to have made a false statement on a DDR. And I guess it's countered by the fact that Mr. Gaines, yes, that's one of the allegations in his warning slips, but there are three additional allegations of misconduct that the employer felt merited warning slips, and that was the insubordination as it relates to the safety complaints, not waxing the vehicle, failure to cooperate with his supervisor, and also the limited output that resulted from refusal to drive the truck. And so should we consider all of the events that occurred within that relatively short period of time and balance with Mr. Gaines and balance that with Mr. Konietzka's false DDR, or are you asking us to focus just on the DDRs because those you think aren't legitimate misconduct disciplines?
With respect to this case, we presented it, I hope, and we certainly see it as each piece of discipline, and there's four. Each of them, we believe we presented pretext evidence to show that they weren't, that K-5 did not honestly believe he violated any of those.
Right, so I'm just talking about trying to come up with an appropriate comparator so we can make a similarly situated analysis. What are you actually asking us to look at as far as presenting Mr. Konietzka as an appropriate comparator? Because according to your own argument, his only action of misconduct that you're asking us to compare Mr. Gaines to is that he falsified his DDR by inaccurately stating his time by 5 minutes.
Sure.
What corollary information are you asking us to say what Gaines did, the nature of his violations were similar enough that we can consider these in this similarly situated analysis?
Well, the similar one is the allegation that he misstated the mechanic's statements on his DDR. That is the similar one. But again, all four of these pieces of discipline are issued at the very same time. We have evidence to prove that all four are pretextual. So I think in a case like that, and I hope in a case like that, that a plaintiff does not have to then show a comparator that engaged in all four or similar acts to all four pieces of discipline.
You're saying these are just invented? These things didn't happen? I mean, we look at levels of insubordination when you're supposed to be somewhere or do something, complaining about trucks, don't like this truck or that truck. Obviously, the one where there's misrepresentation of what the mechanic actually said. These are all obviously fact situations, but are they so invented that you say these are just pretext? It didn't really happen. There really isn't, because you know, insubordination, for example, is subjective. You can't. You got to. And when you talk, as the judge was talking about, is about comparatives. I guess you're saying there are similarly situated people who were treated better than he was.
Well, with Mr. Konietzka and the Rule 10 violation or alleged violation, the falsification, Mr. Konietzka is the comparator. With respect to the three other pieces of discipline, we've taken each one in both of my briefs, and I've broken down each one by one and lined up the pretext evidence for each one. For example, I'll take the first one. April 28th, it was not really called insubordination, but I guess it's similar, failure to cooperate was the first piece of discipline. And again, he didn't get that on April 28th. And nobody told him he was accused of that on April 28th. And the only supervisor he dealt with on April 28th was Mr. Schwartz. And I deposed Mr. Schwartz. And Mr. Schwartz told me clearly he did not believe Diego failed to cooperate in any respect on that day. So that in and of itself to me indicates when Mr. Radke, the decision maker, writes that piece of discipline up, 6 days later, does not talk to Mr. Schwartz about it, does not talk to Mr. Gaines about it, to me, that's a protectual piece of discipline.
So I understand in the protectual setting, but I guess you're asking us to ignore those and only use the DDR Rule 10 violation that Gaines is alleged to have committed in finding an appropriate comparator for him in the similarly situated, because those are invented or pretextual or whatever. Those were not legitimate disciplines, so therefore you're asking us to disregard those and looking for a comparator.
Correct, because I think if you, I like the word disregard, but I think if you don't, you've opened the door to an employer who sits back and says, I don't like that protected activity, days later, in the calmness of their office, I don't like that protected activity, I am going to today issue 10 pieces of discipline and send them to him, and I'm going to call him right now and tell him he's terminated. Well, and then the smart employer sits back and says, he's never going to be able to find anybody similarly situated to this. There's absolutely no way. And let me just say one more thing. The requirement that he show similarly situated, of course, is in the indirect method. There is no requirement to show the similarly situated in the direct method.
Well, what's your best evidence in the direct method?
Well, the direct method is it's all the pretext evidence. It's all the pretext evidence. And I think disparate treatment of Konitska, disparate treatment of the other examples, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Al Lukritz, all of that comes into play in the direct method, which is a mosaic of circumstantial evidence that we've presented to support the direct method. So when we talk about a requirement for similarly situated, we've got to keep in mind it's only requirement on the indirect.
Well, to build a case under the direct method, though, you've got to have something more than the pretext evidence. That's not enough. That may be enough to show that the discipline was imposed mistakenly or erroneously, but not that it was imposed for a discriminatory reason. You need some evidence pointing to national origin discrimination.
We don't have direct evidence. We don't. But direct method doesn't mean
right.
You have to have direct evidence.
What is your circumstantial evidence of discrimination, other than that the decision was made rashly, it was made without sufficient investigation, it was made erroneously? You know, those are all arguments that suggest, you know, he was discharged wrongly, but not that he was discharged for a discriminatory reason.
Well, and retaliatory, don't forget. It's discriminatory and or retaliatory.
But for national origin reasons.
You don't want me to talk about the SDA or the Illinois Public Council.
Yeah, I'd like to get to that, but those are separate counts in the
I would say, let's call it the common body of evidence, would be the decision-makers, again, failure to investigate it properly. I think the evidence shows that he hid evidence and or tampered with it. Remember, he got a statement, a full-bodied written statement.
To suggest that the decision-maker did any of those things with racial motivation or national origin animus, some sort of discriminatory motivation. That's what you need for your Title VII claim and your Title VII retaliation claim. We can get to the other two statutory claims in a moment.
Well, again, he doesn't have direct evidence. There's no statement, and I'm not... he needs direct evidence that
you need
the decision
some circumstantial maker, evidence. Of
I'm trying to explain the circumstantial evidence. To me, when a decision maker destroys notes, when a supervisor destroys his notes, when a decision maker receives a full body written statement from a witness to the event, and then tells the witness to go back and give me a reduced statement.
All right, so we basically don't have anything circumstantial or otherwise to suggest discriminatory motivation. So let's move on to the claim about the truck being
the retaliation.
Not roadworthy.
The retaliation claim, the STA and Illinois Public Policy retaliation claims.
Right, which
okay.
is different from the Title VII retaliation claim.
The main piece of evidence is the fact that the termination followed within 4 days of that activity. We believe the activity is protected under the STAA, and we believe that the district court made an error by taking the facts that defendant presented and assuming that they were true in saying that he didn't engage in protected activity. But the main piece of evidence that you have linking the two is the elapsing of 4 days, but that's not it. The other evidence that shows that the decision maker in this case did not engage in a true and honest investigation, did not talk to Mr. Gaines about any of this, with respect to the April 28th discipline, did not even talk to Mr. Schwartz about what he thought, whether he thought.
The company is claiming that even to the extent that there might be a factual dispute about whether the truck was roadworthy and he was being retaliated against for claiming that it was not, they say that they would have terminated him anyway based on the falsification of the DDR, because that alone was a terminable offense.
Yeah. And I think I put it on my brief that they actually say two different things on that in their brief. They say at one point they would have certainly terminated Diego alone, but then when they address Mr. Lukritz and Mr. Konitska, they indicate they wouldn't have terminated them.
Okay.
So I think that in and of itself shows that they're flip-flopping with respect to that issue.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Morrison.
May it please the Court, I'm Ian Morrison. I represent K5 Construction in this case. And I'd like to address a couple of the points that the Court has raised. First, I believe it was Judge Darrow who asked the question of whether it's proper to mix evidence on the STA and Title VII claims, and we believe that it clearly is not. As the Court has recognized, to prove a Title VII claim of retaliation or discrimination, the plaintiff has the burden of coming forward and persuading the fact finder that there was discrimination based on national origin or retaliation based on having engaged in conduct protected under Title VII. That's a completely different inquiry than whether or not the employee can prove their burden under the STAA or Illinois common law that they were fired in retaliation for having made safety complaints. The facts underlying the two claims are the same. The analysis needs to be separated out, and we think that there is simply no evidence here that Mr. Gaines was terminated based on his national origin or in retaliation for having filed an EEOC charge many months before.
It's true that there would be some overlap in terms of the pretext evidence. The evidence of pretext is relevant on both types of retaliation claim, but whether it's enough is a separate question.
Right. I think that's correct, that there is an overlap. If you get to the point where you're analyzing pretext under STAA or under Title VII, you'll be looking at the same facts.
Right.
There's this same common body of facts that comes into play. On the issue of similarly situated, which a lot of time was devoted to in the briefs, again, we think it is correct for Title VII purposes to take into account all of the relevant circumstances relating to the comparable employees to determine whether or not they're truly similarly situated. And this Court has repeatedly said, including in the Coleman case, which both sides have cited, that you have to take into account all relevant factors in assessing whether an employee is similarly situated. Mr. Konitska had allegedly one instance of falsification, and I pause to note there that his affidavit doesn't actually support that there was any falsification going on. He says he was accused of having written down an extra 5 minutes of time on his timesheet. He doesn't say he didn't work, and there's no evidence that he didn't work. He simply got yelled at, according to him, by the supervisor for having worked extra. That's completely different than a situation like Mr. Gaines, where at the culmination of a series of acts of insubordination and refusal to work, after his safety complaints had been fully addressed, he writes down something that he admits is false. He has admitted over and over again that the statement made by Mr. Johnston that he recounts in his DDR is not correct. And he tries to explain that by saying he can't be held responsible for this technical lingo, but it's undisputed that was a false statement. That makes it instantaneously different than Mr. Konitska's situation. And the two other employees who were identified as being supposedly seemingly similarly situated are not either. Darnell Thomas had a series of attendance issues years before that are simply not comparable to a series of acts of insubordination and refusal to work and falsification. And as to Mr. Lukritz, who's identified as being similarly situated because he, according to Mr. Gaines, must have falsified his timesheet, the only evidence is on that point is what Mr. Gaines says and his opinion of how long it took Mr. Lukritz to test drive the truck. There's no information to suggest that management was ever confronted with that information, and that's the only thing that would make it relevant. On the direct evidence point, I think it suffices to say that there's simply no evidence here of discrimination or retaliation that's protected by Title VII. But counsel also had the burden of articulating an argument under some standard other than the traditional indirect evidence standard in the district court and did not do that. Clearly, they're pointing to evidence now that suggests they could try and make a claim, but that's not enough, and this court's decision in Puffer versus Allstate makes very clear that you can waive various theories of getting at discrimination by not articulating those in the district court.
On the safety complaint retaliation claim, isn't this a very close question about whether the facts are actually in dispute? I know the district court said that they were not, but it does appear that there is a dispute among the parties of an evidentiary nature about whether this was a bona fide complaint about the roadworthiness of the two trucks in question. And the district court seems to have picked the company's interpretation of the evidence over the plaintiff's.
Well, needless to say, I don't agree with that. We think the district court did not get into weighing the evidence improperly here. And I want to step back in answering your question, Judge Sykes, by talking about the statute itself and what it provides. It does not provide that every act related to motor vehicle safety is protected. The provision that was focused on in the district court was the provision that says you cannot be fired for refusing to drive a truck that or a vehicle after having made a, or if you believe reasonably that it's unsafe. And the court looked at the evidence of whether or not a reasonable person, and the statute is a very specific definition of what a reasonable basis to believe a vehicle is unsafe means. The court looked at that objective test and looked at the undisputed evidence about what had happened with respect to the trucks.
But isn't that disputed evidence that goes directly to that inquiry, what happened with the trucks? There's two different versions that are at issue here.
The only question that's at issue is whether or not Mr. Gaines's judgment as to whether or not these trucks were safe was the judgment that a reasonable person in those circumstances would have made.
But aren't there still factual disputes as to the first truck about whether or not there was even an amount of tar that had not been cleaned up? I mean, there's some actual factual disputes still at issue, aren't there?
There is a disagreement in the record on that point as to whether or not it was a film, which I believe is what Mr. Schwartz testified to after testifying that he and Mr. Gaines went at this with a shovel or a rake or hoe and solvent, that whether there was a thin film versus Mr. Gaines' testimony that it was inches. But I don't think the court needs to get to that issue because Mr. Gaines was not terminated for refusing to drive that truck. Management thought it was unreasonable after addressing his complaint to refuse to drive the truck, and he was disciplined for that, given a warning. But the termination, when he said, I'm not going to drive the truck, he was given another truck to drive and went about his way. The statute also says that it's not reasonable if you've complained to the company about the safety issue and they've addressed it. And I think that applies to both of the trucks because 4279, the truck with the asphalt on the spread pan, that issue had been addressed. Mr. Gaines may have subjectively believed it was still unsafe, but I think that the record evidence was enough for the court to conclude it objectively was safe.
Can you clarify the company's position as to why they terminated him? I know that I think the position was is that they would certainly be within their rights to terminate him just for the Rule 10 DDR alleged fabrication. Is that correct?
Correct.
But was that the actual basis?
Well, the basis was that, and I think this was clear in the record, looking at the events of the last several days and factoring in the fact that he still had a prior warning from the year before in his file, Mr. Gaines couldn't be trusted to continue to perform his duties. The Rule 10 violation, the handbook for drivers clearly says that a violation of that rule may result in discharge. It doesn't have steps before that. It's quite clear in saying this is a terminable offense. And so for purposes of the STAA, if we were to get to that inquiry, if we believe that the evidence was undisputed, they would have terminated for that alone.
What is that evidence?
That he would have – it's the undisputed evidence about what the driver's manual provides.
Right. That just says it's a dischargeable offense.
Correct.
But do we have something from the company, from some decision-maker at the company that says that we would have terminated him for that reason alone, even if the other violations were not at issue?
I don't believe we have a direct – piece of testimony on that point. Frankly, as I said before, we don't get to that issue because we don't think his conduct was protected under the Act. And the only question is, this is something you only get to if you disagree with us and find that his conduct was protected under the Act. Then the statute provides you're still not liable if you would have terminated anyway.
Right. So we don't really have any evidence on that point. We just have argument.
Well, I think the evidence is clear they would have terminated him anyway because of a number of different factors. And I think counsel was, in talking about this issue and sort of accusing us of taking inconsistent positions, is, again, mixing the claims. Well, for Title VII purposes, and I don't want to clarify this point, for Title VII purposes, you do need to look at all of circumstances of each of the comparable employees, and for that purpose, it's relevant to look at all of this disciplinary history. I think if we were to get to a trial on the issue of whether or not we would have terminated anyway for STAA purposes, it's clear that the offense under Rule 10 was one that would have resulted in his termination had that happened alone.
Was it a requirement that Gaines report any safety concerns on the DDR? Was that a mandatory reporting requirement under the work policy?
What it required was that he report repair requests, and it didn't require that he report safety issues. He certainly could, and there was no issue with that. He did that. Those were addressed.
But it seems there's an accumulation of things. Is this the nail in the coffin with the misrepresentation on the report? Were there four people who got together and made this decision that he's got to go?
There were three.
Three, whatever it was. The group that got together, and then looking at sort of an accumulation of complaints, I guess, that they had, and then this final one where he said, well, that's a terminable offense in any event. I'm just wondering if that's what happened. This is culmination and this is the last straw kind of thing.
Well, and I think that's a fair way to look at it.
To look at it because from a distance, because that's sort of what appears, because otherwise if you just parse each one of them, you can figure maybe they're irritants but not necessarily terminal.
And I think it's also important to take into account the fact that this was not a situation like the one counsel described where employer was sitting back in its office banking up alleged discipline, and when the employee makes a safety complaint, they pull out their drawer full of discipline. The incidents in question happened on Thursday and Friday, or Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of the preceding week. The decision to terminate is made when management are able to meet on Monday and talk about this. And they look at the situation, and that group was Robert G. Krug, Mr. Radke, and Ms. Burke from Human Resources, looked at the situation and concluded that the only course they could take was termination. Obviously, Mr. Gaines disagrees with that. It's not the decision he would have made if he were in that situation. But that's not enough for him to prove any of his claims. He needs to prove that either he was terminated because he made a safety complaint that that was an objectively reasonable safety complaint, or that he was terminated because of his national origin or because he'd made an EEOC charge.
If it was determined that his safety concerns were in fact reasonable and protected under STAA, would the information, if it had been accurate, on the DDR be protected activity?
We don't believe it would be, and as we've noted in our brief, there's nothing in the STAA, and in fact this court's Formella decision speaks to this, that protects false information. And so, you know, the Formella decision talks about how you can still be terminated, notwithstanding the STAA, for making safety complaints in an inappropriate way. And so if you're falsifying information in the course of making those complaints, we submit that wouldn't be protected.
What do you make of the Title VII analogy in which, as long as there's a good faith and it's a sincerely held belief that the representation is accurate, that should actually be protected activity? In that setting, do you think that that's analogous to an STAA setting?
I don't think so, and I think, again, you have to go back to the language of the STAA that's at issue here. The statute protects participation in proceedings, and the roadway decision that counsel cites, I think, is distinguishable, and he's attempting to sort of make this point that simply submitting the DDR was protected, but roadway doesn't say that. Roadway is dealing with a situation where employee B is terminated for participating in employee A's arbitration that has to do with whether or not employee A falsified safety records or truck records. So he was participating in a proceeding having to do with, you know, motor carrier safety issues. That made his case completely distinguishable from this one, where he's simply writing a form and turning it in with false information.
All right.
Request the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Coffee, your time had expired, but we kept you going with questions, so I'll give you a couple of minutes in rebuttal if you have something further.
Well, I'll just try to pick up with roadway. Again, this is not a case where counsel or defendants have produced any evidence that there's anything other than a good faith belief when Diego writes his April 30th DDR and tries to capture what he's told by this mechanic. There's no evidence at all to suggest he is purposely falsifying anything. And I think the Title VII analogy is good. He has a good faith belief at that time that what he writes in his DDR is what he is told by this individual. And there's no evidence to the contrary, and there are certainly no cases that counsel has come up with that suggest that that analogy should not be followed or is not good. And there's no language in the STAA that differentiates it from the retaliatory provision of the Title VII or ADA or any of the other acts. So we think that analogy is good. With respect to Judge Darrow's question on what information drivers are required to put in these DDRs, it's a very good question. If you look at what K5 did in their brief, at page 5 of the brief, they state that the drivers are required to log, quote-unquote, any problems with their trucks on their DDRs. At page 26 of their brief, they omit the any problems. And I think that's important because at page 26, they're trying to make this claim that what Diego wrote was gratuitous. He didn't have to do it. And so, of course, when they go to describe the requirement on page 26, they forget all about what they had just said on page 25, that he has to report any problems. In addition to that, the picture that we've submitted presents a factual dispute as to how much caked on asphalt was on truck 4279. Diego not only has testified to it, he's got a picture of it. You can see from this color picture that it is a multiple inch stack of caked on hardened asphalt. He refuses to drive that truck because he has previous experience with loads popping. He has previous experience with, Supervisor Schwartz states that there's a rule that requires these drivers to clean their tail pans, and there's a good reason for that rule, according to Supervisor Schwartz. It's a safety concern. So when he sees a truck and it's got inches of caked on asphalt and he knows he's going to take it onto the interstate and drive 55 miles an hour and hit potholes, he has a reasonable belief. That was just one of the facts that the district court took the other way and took K-5's side on.
All right.
We thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.